Most, if not all of you in this room, are already familiar with Genesis 1. But it is more than merely an account of the beginning of all things. It is something of a polemic, a challenge, a shot across the bow against alternative accounts of the origins of the universe that were held by other ancient Near Eastern communities. What do I mean by that? There are Babylonian accounts of the creation of the world, and by their account, the world is the result of a cosmic clash between warring deities. What does Genesis say? Genesis posits that all things came to be simply by the command of God. The most famous creation account of Mesopotamian origin, the Enuma Elish, it depicts the various gods that gave rise to the creation of the world and that how those gods share in the same indiscriminate and harsh features as that of creation itself. What does Genesis say? Genesis argues that God saw his creation as good, sought to provision it for its ongoing good, and therefore God was an ally to its his creation, not its foe. And so Genesis is challenging conventional wisdom of that day by offering an alternative version of the origin of the universe. Why am I bringing that up? Our passage this morning in John chapter 1, besides its similarity in theme to what Genesis 1 is saying, is also in some sense a polemic. It is a challenge against the conventional wisdom of that day, of John's day. Instead of saying at the beginning of John 1, in the beginning was Jesus, and Jesus was with God because Jesus was God, Jesus was in the beginning with God. Instead of saying that, John says, in the beginning was the Word. And all you Greek scholars in the room know that the word Word there in the Greek is the word Logos. To a Greek audience, which was John's primary audience, Logos was pregnant with meaning. Ha, no pun intended. Luc Ferry is a contemporary French philosopher. He wrote a book a few years ago called The Short History of Thought, in which he explains that the original meaning of the word Logos among the Greek philosophers was the underlying structure, the harmony, the order of the universe, the ordered, rational, immutable reality of all things. That's how they termed the word Logos. It was an impersonal but real description of the divine perfections of the universe. When you said Logos back then, that's what you meant. This underlying, impersonal, but real and structured framework. Real wisdom, therefore, by those same philosophers, would come by apprehending the Logos, by coming to understand that structure. In fact, they would say that your very salvation, as they even coined the term, was about coming to understand the Logos. But that understanding the Logos was all on you. You had to think, reason, and contemplate the world as it is. It's on you to, if you will, get the Logos and live by the Logos. So for John to let the word Logos preface his whole account of Jesus' life is both to confront the original meaning of the word and to reappropriate it. It is to argue that, yes, there is, in fact, an underlying structure to the universe, but it is not impersonal. It is personal. For John to say that the Logos came to earth is to agree that wisdom comes from apprehending that Logos, but it's the Logos that actually became like one of us, like those who were in need of that wisdom so that they might gain that wisdom. During Advent, we are asking one simple but profound question. Why does the incarnation matter? From John 1, what we're going to learn today is that by Jesus coming in the flesh, we learn about the divinity of God and to a degree that was unprecedented. At the end of the passage, you just heard him, Mark, read, "No one has ever seen God, the only God," which there it's referring to God as Jesus, God the Son. "No, the only God, God the Son, who is at the Father's side, he has made God known." Known how? How has Jesus made divinity known? We want to ask that question. And from John 1, I think we're going to find three answers to it. By the incarnation, Jesus has made known the nature of divinity, the paradox of divinity, and if you will, the brilliance of divinity. The nature of divinity, the paradox of divinity, and the brilliance of divinity. So let's go. First, the nature of divinity. In the first part of the passage, John's going to tell us about attributes of the divinity of God that we would expect him to say if we know anything about Genesis 1, because that's the section or the scripture to which John 1 alludes. When John begins his gospel with the words, "In the beginning was the Word," he's not just making a temporal marker, like, let's start here. He's actually saying, God is outside existence. Okay, gird up your loins here, because this is some thick stuff, right? He is saying that God is prior to all that is, that he is the author of very being itself. He is therefore contingent, that is, dependent or derivative upon nothing. He has the feature or the attribute that theologians like to use the word called aseity. It's a big word. It means that all things derive from him, whereas he derives from nothing else. That's what it means to have the attribute of aseity. None of you have the attribute of aseity. You came from something else. All your thoughts derive from something before it. David Bentley Hart is a trenchant Orthodox theologian. I've referenced him before. I may have even quoted him before on this count. But listen to what he says about God's transcendence in this sense. God is what grounds the existence of every contingent thing, making it possible, sustaining it through time, unifying it, giving it actuality. God is the condition of the possibility of anything existing at all. He is not just some especially resplendent object among all the objects illuminated by the light of being. He is the light of being itself. Get your head around that. To say, therefore, as we are prone to say, that God exists is actually to put God in the same category as other things that exist, like this pulpit or Kevin's guitar. And as hallowed as those things might be, notwithstanding, God is not in the same category of either of those hallowed objects. God is above that category because existence itself is dependent on God. All right, that's heavy. Bear with me. If God possesses that attribute of aseity, of transcendence, it follows that he would likewise have the attribute of potency and of creativity, a word that you and I maybe like to put under the word that we're familiar with, omnipotence, right? And that's what we get out here in verse 3. All things were made through him. Without him was not anything made that was made. That's the argument of verse 3. And so right off the bat, John is going fast. Aseity, transcendence, potency, creativity, omnipotence, these are the attributes that we tend to attribute to divinity already if you have any familiarity with Judeo-Christian tradition. None of that should be new. What Jesus uniquely reveals, or perhaps uniquely clarifies about divinity in the first part of this passage, is that intrinsic to God's nature is community. Jesus, who is the Logos, the underlying structure of the universe, was with God, for he himself was God, which means that God in himself has not existed as a solitary being, but as something else. Something not in solitude, but in community. And it's a text like this that those who reflect upon it in the decades and centuries since that time eventually built their case for a Trinitarian view of God. That is his nature, that he is triune. Jesus is here being equated with God, and then later in John's gospel, we're going to see the Holy Spirit spoken of as equal with God, and yet himself also a person in God. And therefore, while no discussion of the Trinity can avoid getting bogged down in some pretty heady stuff pretty quickly, the reason I bring it up to you is that the existence, or rather the significance of God's nature being in community, is that that means that there's something else intrinsic to his nature. Namely, love. Love. Now, you and I take that for granted if we were reared within earshot of Judeo-Christian tradition or not. We just assume that. Even the nominally religious folk in Western civilization assume, if they have any faith in God, assume that he's loving. But on what basis could anyone really assume that? Why should you believe that, besides the fact that you would just like to believe it? In his book, Delighting in the Trinity, whom I think we've referenced before, I think Jane Peterson even recommended it to us several weeks ago in Q&A, Michael Reeves, he cataloged the various attempts to understand the nature of divinity among theologians and religious folk across the theological spectrum. They all tried to understand what is the true nature of divinity. Aristotle, he tried to figure out how could the divine, as he understood it, how could the divine be intrinsically good if he had nothing to be good to before there was creation? If he had no object unto which he could be good, how could we say that goodness was essential to his nature? And therefore, Aristotle posited, well, that means, therefore, that creation must have existed eternally, because only that way could God be said to be eternally good. Michael Reeves also references the belief held by our Muslim friends, who say that Allah has 99 names, one of which is the name the Loving. But for Allah to be loving, Michael Reeves argues, that means that he has to have had something to love forever, which means that he would need creation in order to be loving. But according to Islam, Allah needs nothing. And therefore, in Michael Reeves' minds, that sort of creates a certain tension. How can Allah be loving if he did not always have something to love and depends on nothing? What, therefore, would prove that at the center of what divinity is love? What would prove that is that this God would have one to give love to and to receive love from eternally. Only then could one say that God has love as an essential attribute to its nature. Since only then would that God have the opportunity and inspiration to exercise love at all times. And so what we hear hinted at in John 1 is seen as its full glory in John 17, when Jesus in his high priestly prayer says this, "Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am to see my glory that you have given me, because you loved me before the foundation of the world." That Jesus was before all things with God and is God himself, and that God the Father has loved the Son and the Son has loved the Father eternally is testimony to the fact that the nature of divinity is love in community. And so when verse 4 says, "In him, in Jesus, was life, and the life was the light of men," that makes perfect sense. Because if God is by nature love in community, then it would mean that he would have a prime interest in extending to his creation true life, because that's what true love does. God has been in the business of loving eternally because God, three in one, has been loving eternally. Michael Reeves quotes a passage from C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, in which the elder demon gives a profile of the God whose people that Screwtape and Wormwood are trying to subvert and tempt and lead astray. And so he tells to his underling demon, he says, "One must face the fact that all the talk about his love for men and his service being perfect freedom is not, as one would gladly believe, mere propaganda, but an appalling truth. He really does want to fill the universe with a lot of loathsome little replicas of himself, creatures whose life on its miniature scale will be qualitatively like his own, not because he has absorbed them, but because their wills freely conform to his. We want cattle who can finally become food, but he wants servants who can finally become sons. We want to suck in, he wants to give out. We are empty and would be filled, he is full and flows over." That's God. That's the nature of God. That can only be true of God if God has always been loving. And in community, he has. So let me boil it down for you then. What's the nature of the divine? You might say that God is above all things, yet for even the smallest of things. Above, yet for. Divinity is the origin of nebulae and quasars and dark matter and comets, and yet has concern for something as infinitesimally smaller as you. And so one very practical takeaway from this little cosmological metaphysical tour is this. If the divine is above yet for, is that how you see God? Is this your view of him? Do you see him as primarily and essentially and centrally loving? Or do you see him as mostly disappointed with you? Now, I know that you might come back and say, "But isn't God full of wrath at times?" To be sure, and we will point to a moment later in the sermon where he is, but wherever God shows his wrath, it is always unfolding in the context of a jealous love for his own and a jealous love for what is good, a good which if only his own would recognize its goodness, they would come to benefit from it. Divine nature is above all things, yet even for the smallest of things. And Jesus, by his incarnation, shows us the nature of divinity. But he also shows us the paradox of divinity, too. And I get that from what we find in verses 9 through 13. John is going to fast forward to God the Son's earthly life, and he's going to summarize very succinctly what he will unpack in the rest of his account. But he says in verse 9, "The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him." Jesus, as you know very well, if you know anything about him, made pretty scandalous claims about himself. But he validated those claims by what he said and what he did. And yet, the credibility of his testimony notwithstanding, he was construed as a charlatan, and then as a blasphemer, and ultimately as a subversive. And those who had him convicted and killed didn't see him as he was. They didn't know him as he was. And in turn, their way of not receiving him was actually rejecting him. And in turn, that shows us one part of the paradox of divinity. And it's this. Despite all that's true of divinity's nature, aseity, transcendence, and omnipotence, you and I can miss it. And not just be aloof to it, but actually deny it and dismiss it. And even suppress it, like push it aside, like I don't want to believe that. Like I've quoted to you the the rather respected atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel in the past, who is very mindful and really calls out some of the new atheists for some of their very bad logic. But he himself was even quoted to say, "I don't believe in God because I don't want to believe that there is a God." We're going to talk next week about how the incarnation helps us to know true humanity, but what's true of our nature is our capacity to reject the reality in the presence of divinity, no matter how evidently divinity manifests itself. And that's why we read Romans 1 in our confession of sin, because that's what Paul is getting at. Fundamental to us is a preference for what is material rather than what is immaterial and divine. And you know what? At some level, that's okay. We learn to navigate this world by touching stuff and feeling stuff and eating stuff and smelling stuff and seeing stuff. So we are oriented to our world through the material. That's fine. The problem, though, lies in our preference to ascribe an almost divine-like status to things that are of this world. What do I mean? Let's go back to Luke Ferry's book here on A Short History of Thought for a moment. He's going to quote the first century Greek Stoic, Epictetus. Everybody was so popular back then, everybody only had first names. He argued, don't you know Patrick? Haven't you heard of Patrick? Right. Epictetus argued that true grasp of divine wisdom means that you never become too attached to anything. Here's a quote from him. "The principal and highest form of training, and one that stands at the very entrance to happiness, is that when you become attached to something, let it not be as to something which cannot be taken away. Remind yourself that what you love is mortal, that what you love is not your own. It is granted you for the present, and not irrevocably." And then he says, oh, so too starkly, he says, "What harm is it that when you kiss your child, you whisper in their ear, 'Tomorrow you will die'?" It's stark. Is it not true? Epictetus was saying that true happiness can only be found so long as you don't become too attached to anything, that you don't make anything in this decaying world your ultimate happiness. There's much that we would have to quibble with about Mr. Epictetus's words, right? But Paul is in some sense holding forth with Epictetus when he argues that we have an instinct to make anything in this world our overarching path to happiness. That we forget that all those things that we love so much will fail us in time. Except he wouldn't use the word happiness. He would say the word worship, because we think what will make us most happy is what we are in effect worshiping. That instinct to become attached inordinately to what will in the end fail us, the instinct to exchange our worship of God for what only derives from God, is what invariably causes us to miss, deny, and suppress the evidence of divinity. That's one side of the paradox. For all that divinity is in its nature, we prefer our own divine-like substitutes. The other side of the paradox is this. You and I are meant to know God and thus to worship God, but we will never know Him apart from His enabling us to do so. Verses 12 and 13 make that point. "But to all who did receive Him, who believed in His name, He gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God." Again, John is compressing a lot in a few words that he will spend the rest of his gospel unpacking, but he is essentially saying two things in those two verses. One, that we come to know God not as a being with a certain dossier, a certain set of attributes. We come to know God fundamentally as a Father. If we become unto him children, that means we come to know him as a father. As one who has power and wisdom and strength, to be sure, but mostly as one who is loving. And even if we had horrible fathers, the reason we believe that they might have been horrible is because we have a sense of what it might have been for them to have been wonderful. We come to know God not as a being with features, but as a father. But secondly, that knowledge comes to us by the exercise of divine will and work alone. In other words, you are as helpless to affect that kind of knowledge as you were your own birth. That's what John's saying about the paradox. Yeah, you're meant to know him. We're meant to know him. We're meant to worship him, but you'll never know him unless God makes a way for you to do so. Two very practical implications from that deep, rich, thick, heavy paradox. One, it gives occasion for gratitude. Since any knowledge of him, any trust or rest in him is attributable only to him, even though the knowledge of God is mediated through 1,000 counselors, events, experiences, readings, quiet times, prayers, whatever it might be. What does Jesus say in Luke 11 as the disciples are living out their allegiance to his call? He says, "I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and understanding and revealed them to little children." Yes, Father, such was your gracious will. Jesus is thanking God the Father for their understanding. Haven't we, who are the beneficiaries of that knowledge, all the more reason for gratitude? The paradox is an occasion for gratitude. It's also an occasion for prayer. Because in the moments of the absence of trust and rest, it is an occasion for seeking rest and trust from him, not ourselves, not our memory, not our past, not our present, but from God. As I was reading in Psalm 71 yesterday, the first two verses are a call to God to be a refuge for him. He says, "In you, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me, rescue me, incline your ear to me, save me, be to me a rock of refuge to which I may continually come." The psalmist already knows God as a rock of refuge. Otherwise, he wouldn't ascribe to him that category. And yet he's asking God to be a rock of refuge for him. The need for rest gives rise to the call for rest. And if that rest is from God, then it is never not fitting to ask it from him. When it says in our passage, "The light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it," the tense of the verb there is meant for us to say that the light is still shining in the darkness, still giving light, and therefore what still gives light must be approached to benefit from its light. Prayer is approaching where the light is to see all things by it. Prayer is its own paradox. I know. If God knows all, why are we telling him anything? If God can do all, why are we asking for anything? I don't know. He said, pray. And it's that prayer that fits squarely within the paradox of divinity. And by Jesus, we know him. By him, we know the nature of divinity, the paradox of divinity, and finally, we know the brilliance of divinity. On Wednesday night, I'm going to reference a celebrated dialogue in one of the most famous works of literary history. It's Fyodor Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. And it's a dialogue early in the book between two of the brothers, Ivan, who is a wild, almost frenetic, iconoclastic young soul. And he's talking to his younger brother, Alyosha, who is tender and equally passionate and preparing for the priesthood. And in the midst of their conversation, Ivan is reveling in the intrinsic wondrousness of just the simplest things. And he says to Alyosha, he says, "Sticky spring leaves, the blue sky. I love them. That's all. Such things you love, not with your mind, not with logic, but with your insides, your guts. To love God as a father, I think, is to love him with more than cool logic. It is to love him, as Yvonne says, with your insides, with your guts. But brothers and sisters, how does that ever come to be? How does that rise up within us? You can only come to love him with your insides when you come to see how much he loved you first. But what compounds your appreciation for the love of divinity is the brilliance in which that love was manifested. What do I mean by that? Why is it the case that in a war, or even in a game of chess, why is it that the general or the player who lost the battle or who lost the match, why do they feel a strong sense of admiration for the one that bested them? Because it's only in that context that they see the brilliance with which their adversary prosecuted their purpose. They may have lost, but they are in a sense moved to have been in the presence of such skill, such competence, such wisdom, such brilliance. And you might even call that admiration a veiled form of love. Not only is the love of God in Jesus moving because it moved first, but also because it moved with brilliance. Now, in what sense did it move with brilliance? In the sense that it was not a last-minute, plan B, slipshod, piecemeal act on God's part. It was reasoned. It was planned. It was ordered. And in Jesus, God solved the ostensibly insoluble. How so? Moses is mentioned in the last part of our passage one time. But his presence, I think, looms large in a number of ways in this last passage. In Exodus 33, Moses is asking God to go with Israel into the land, despite Israel having thrown off God's authority. And then Moses says unto God, "Show me your glory." And God says, "I'll show you my goodness, but I'm not going to show you my glory because you'll die if you see it in its fullness." And then God proceeds to rattle off several of his own attributes. Attributes those who know him as a father are meant to replicate in their own lives. Attributes that sadly do not take hold in us with any consistency or sincerity. And so from eternity past, God made a plan to become like us so that we might become like him. God shows us an even fuller degree of his glory in Jesus, glory that Moses was longing to see. And by showing us that glory, he leads us to become like him who is glorious. And central to that glory is the grace of God. For from his fullness, it says in verse 16, we have all received grace upon grace. Again, there's echoes of Moses here. Because see, when Israel had disobeyed God in an egregious way two chapters earlier in Exodus 31, what does Moses do? He offers to sacrifice himself on the behalf of the people. And what does God say? "I won't take your sacrifice." Because Moses' sacrifice wouldn't have been enough to cover their sin. What does Jesus do brilliantly? What does divinity do brilliantly? Jesus Christ, who is both man and God, he sends himself as a sacrifice, and his sacrifice is sufficient. And it's in that sacrifice that we receive, all of us, grace upon grace, grace overflowing. That's a brilliant expression of love. And where Moses is mentioned explicitly in our text in verse 17, "For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." It's tempting there to interpret John's meaning as a bald contrast, as if to say, hey, the law came with Moses, but you know what? Jesus brought something new and different, grace and truth. That's how you might read it. That's not what I think John intends by his meaning. because the law itself was an expression of grace and truth. We studied the Ten Commandments this summer. Of course, the law acted as a guide to our happiness in God. And if it was a guide to our happiness, then it was an unmerited happiness, and therefore it's a grace. And if the law expresses accurately the will of God, then of course truth is bound up in the law. So it's not as if there wasn't grace and truth in the law, and then grace and truth came later in Jesus. That's not the case. John's not making a stark contrast. He's making a how much more argument. Moses was a courier, so to speak, of God's law, but Jesus embodied grace and truth. Moses championed the gracious, truthful law of God, but Jesus fulfills the law while extending us grace without sacrificing the truth of God's holiness. It's brilliant. Jesus does all that we cannot do so that we might begin to do what he can. There are moments when we feel intense love for someone, for their humor, their personality, even their eccentricities. But there are other moments when we so appreciate them for their utter wisdom, their shimmering brilliance. I'm not just going to tell you those things in which God's love was brilliant to us in Jesus, and I'm expecting you to just sort of, brilliant. Now I love him with my guts. But it will be by the grace of the Spirit and our own contemplation upon his work that we might, in fact, love him with our insides. For as we love our fathers with our insides, so we must learn to love the Father with our insides. By his incarnation, we see the brilliance of divinity, because God did what we least expect, but what we most needed. What's the final take home? If divinity is above and yet for, if divinity is evident in his work and yet known only by his working in us, if divinity does what we least expect, but what we most needed, then what is it to know divinity as Jesus has uniquely made divinity known? Let me put it to you in a very practical way. The degree to which you know divinity is evident by the degree to which divinity is expressed through you. Paul Tripp said it like this very recently. To the degree that you forget the grace that you have been given, to that same degree it is easier for you not to extend grace to others. To the extent that you forget how much you've been forgiven, to that same extent it is easier for you not to forgive the people in your life. In other words, he's saying, your understanding of true divinity is finely calibrated to your manifestation of the same through you, which is a frightening thought, a sobering thought. Grace and forgiveness from you is an indicator of your grasp of the grace and forgiveness to you. And when you can't show it, it is attributable to one of two reasons. Either because you don't think you need it, or because you think God would never be willing to show you the same. Brothers and sisters, I would ask you to reflect upon your own heart, mostly by reflecting upon your own relationships, my own relationships, and to the extent I am offering grace to whom it is needed, for whom would benefit from it, to whom am I showing forgiveness that would benefit from such? While this passage is all about the divine, at its heart, it's telling us to live divinely, full of grace and truth, extending both as they've been extended to us. And the only way we'll can is if we listen to John's bow shot across the bow of the Greek Stoic philosophers. Because the Greeks believed that while the Logos was the structure of the universe that would never change and must be accepted, Jesus, the true Logos, is the one that breaks into the reality that is to subvert the way things are, that what needs not to be accepted is to be accepted in Him, and that what He rises again and then says, follow Him. That's what the incarnation is. That's why the incarnation matters. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.